My love for dance music and infatuation with rave started when I was very young. Some of my earliest memories I have of music are hearing trance tunes in the charts when I was 5 or 6 and being captivated by the euphoric feeling it gave me even then as a child. By the time I was 10, I'd grown what I call a musical intelligence or taste and fell in love with that 05 dance floor filler sound, such as songs like Call On Me, My 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 and Lola's Theme. As I grew, I was heavily influenced by my big brother Adam, who was a music head of many kinds, and brought me on a music journey of dance genres that shaped my life forever. From hardcore to gabba, electro, house, bassline, we listened to it all. Our favourite landing not exclusively, but mainly in drum and bass. My first rave was on my 18th birthday at a players' night in Fabric. I felt like I'd been raving my whole life and knew I had found a new home full of like-minded people, and that essence followed me round to whatever genre I found myself raving to. 8 years since my 18th birthday. I've had quite the journey. From paying to get into raves to playing them. I've always felt at home in that environment as a raver and a performer, and I've often found myself wondering if rave is still the same as it was now social media and mobiles and the way music is even consumed has changed. I realise that my generation don't know what any of that was like. We open up Logic to make tunes, use YouTube to find tunes and CDJs to mix tunes. I wanted to start a podcast educating myself and my fellow millennial ravers, and really anyone interested, about the uprising of electronic music and hear stories from the pioneers themselves about how their journey through music has shaped them and their careers. I've asked each of these dance legends to bring along 3 tracks that has impacted them, changed them, or reminds them of the good old days. I've brought my own tracks along to define why that person is my guest. I'll be talking to the legendary DJ Andy C about how the scene has changed over the last 20 years. The groundbreaking jungle king Ronnie Size chats to me about the influence he continues to have. And with 5 decades behind the decks, Pete Tong tells me all about why Ibiza is so important. My first guest is DJ Zinc, who has constantly redefined his sound and has moved effortlessly between music genres from house to breakbeat, UK garage to drum and bass, selling over 1 million physical records. I hope you enjoy as we delve into the art of rave. Kicking off my brand new podcast this week, I am chatting to the legend that is DJ Zinc. Thank you so much for coming on the show and
welcome. You're welcome. Does legend mean you don't know when to give up?
No, legend means the person who has got me into drum and bass from a young age, and I've seen how your career has taken all sorts of twists and turns, and I thought you were an incredible person to start off with because I've seen you go through so many different genres.
Well, yes, so I wasn't fishing for a compliment, but it's very, very kind of you to say it like that. Yeah, I've done different genres. I've made music of different genres over the years. And
you've probably been doing it for my... I don't mean to make you feel old, but you've probably been doing it for my entire lifetime.
Yeah, probably.
Professionally.
Yeah. Which year were you born?
94.
So in 1994, I'd already been on Pirate Radio for 3 years. And in 1994, I just started... That's when I met DJ Hype around that time. So I started... developing the productions that I was working on. In 1993, I made my first track through somebody I'd met from Pirate Radio.
Right.
And then, so then by 94, 95 was when I was meeting the other DJs in club environments. And that was when I was, developing. And I met Hype. He was really helpful with my production. And so 94, that was just before I did Super Sharpshooter. So, yeah.
That's madness to me. I mean, look. The reason why I've asked you here today is because this podcast I wanted to create was an idea that was about educating my generation of ravers how rave has changed over the years.
Okay.
Do you think that now technology has developed so much and we've got all of the stations at our fingertips, do you think that's a good thing for my generation, or do you think that has kind of watered it down slightly?
I think that it is... With nearly everything to do with progress and technology, I think that it's 90% good and 10% bad.
Right.
And, you know, it's I was very frustrated that I couldn't find music that I wanted to listen to.
Right.
You know, you might go to a rave on a Saturday and you would hear this music, but you'd hear it in a club environment. So it's like the noises bouncing around on the walls. And I never used to drink or do anything like that. So I was always really like clear-headed and paying attention to the music, but nevertheless, how a tune sounds in a club versus how a tune sounds on the radio is very different. The same tune can sound completely different. So I'd be hearing these tunes thinking, you know, what's the one that goes da-da-da? What's the one that goes like this? And then waiting during the week to see if possibly a pirate radio DJ is going to play that same tune. It was really hard to find the music that you wanted to listen to. You could get the tape packs from certain raves, but then that would be a few weeks after the rave, and again you're limited to hearing what those club DJs are playing. So it was, for me, it's like it's 90% better now. The 10% is that the way it's not better is that you used to really have to work hard to find this stuff. So when you found it, I think you had, you know, like you say, a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
If there was a song that you had heard for a year in clubs and you don't know what this tune is, and it goes dun 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 dun, and you go into shops and they say, I don't know what that is, and you go into all these places and you're singing it and they say, I don't know what it is, and then you get the record, you're just like, yes.
That's what it is.
By Rhythm is Rhythm. This is what it is. I wonder what it was, and that's what it is. I used to work in a record shop, and people used to come in and sing bass lines from songs.
Where did you work in a record
shop? I worked in Boogie Times.
Where was
that? In Watford, which was the label that Suburban Bass. It was the shop, the label Suburban Bass, which was one of the biggest jungle drum and bass labels.
No way.
They had a shop called Boogie Times. I used to work there on a Saturday.
So did you used to have people coming in being like, I've got this song, dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
And you would have to be the human Shazam.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Completely. And I mean, I had for years gone into shops singing bass lines and saying, what's the one that goes, no one can compete because I heat like a fireball? And they would say, that's Fireball by Chrome and Time. You know, and then now I was on the other side with people coming in and having to try and exactly human Shazam.
Oh, I have so many questions about this, but let me, as you were singing the bass line.
Yeah, so the bass line I just sang was It Is What It Is, which is one of the first tracks that I, when I first got into electronic music, this was one of the tracks that stood out for me, and it's still one of my favourite tracks of all time. And it's like the kind of blueprint for everything I've done since.
Right.
So it's...
this is the tune that was in 1988, right?
Exactly. So it's got a big bass line. It's got quite moody elements to it.
Yeah, let's play It Is What It Is, Rhythm Is Rhythm.
This is one of the ones where I went into the shop and sung the bass line, you know.
Okay, Andy, fucking C.
Language.
Sorry, it's my podcast. I'm doing what the fuck I like.
I can do what I want.
So... I think the first time I met you was, well, the first time I met you was in some dodgy little cabin at the back of Global Gathering.
And it was, yes.
And I managed to sneak my way into your dressing room.
Amazing.
And you looked at me as if I started gushing about how much of a fan I was of yours. And I just saw this look on your face go, how did she get here? Who did she show her boobs to the security guard? How did she get here? I was actually with Rudimental at the time. I was touring with Rudimental.
Yes, you were.
And I then, once this kind of look kind of glazed across your face, I then decided to go, oh, I'm the girl that did Afterglow.
Exactly.
And everything changed.
It all fell into place.
It did.
And that kind of blew my mind, that moment, having played that tune 1,000 times by then, and you know, been amazed by the vocal on that tune.
Thanks very much.
It was incredible.
Thanks. It was because I don't think it had, technically, I don't think it had been released when I first met you. I think you were playing it in your sets. I'm not sure whether the release date had happened, but yeah. And then we got into the studio with Tom Aspel, and it was me, you, and Tom.
Yeah.
And I think where I'd like to start is the story you told me in studio with how Ram was created.
Yeah.
And what I'd like to know is how prevalent drum and bass was at the time, if it was, because for me, I've only ever been brought up with drum and bass. It's been 25 years, really, and that it's been going from strength to strength, and now is an unstoppable genre in the UK, especially, and across Europe. But how did it all begin for you?
Well, it all began for me. Drum and bass didn't exist when it began for me. It was my sister took me to a my sister's 5 years older, and she was going out to all the early raves like Sunrise and Fantasia and this, that, and the other. And she was I just wanted to be part of her gang, you know, pirate radio. We was listening to Centrefalls when I was getting up for school in the morning, and I was nicking mixtapes off her and drawing acid faces and all that on them and this, that, and the other. And she took me and my best mate James to an illegal rave in a barn in Essex, which was billed as an engagement party, but it was actually a rave. And I was 13. And yeah, we went to that, and that was the first time I'd had any kind of experience of a rave or the whole, you know, everything that goes. I mean, it was exciting. It was exciting. It weren't that full, but it was a dusty barn with a few lights and some DJs playing, apparently. And that's where my journey into loving this music began. And the obsession began, but, you know, hooking up with Ant to make tunes.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mm-hmm. We was finding ourselves and, you know, making... I was obsessed with Shut Up and Dance, listening to pirate radio, and I was also obsessed with anything with a breakbeat in it, funk records, sampling them. And the early tunes were basically 128 BPM, and they just had bucket loads of breaks in there and loads of bleeps and loads of mad sounds. And I guess you'd call them hardcore.
Right.
But I didn't know. Drum and bass didn't exist. Jungle didn't exist at that point.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's where my musical journey began. And Ram was born out of, you know, 16. Just done my exams at school, I think. I can't remember doing them. But, you know, I didn't pick up the results. You know, my best mate, James, who actually came on a jolly with us to Margate last weekend because I did a gig in Dreamland in Margate, he actually picked up the exam results for me, bless him. I think he's still got them.
No way.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't want to know. I just want to be a DJ, man. You know.
Do you still not know?
Yeah, I do, and there's nothing to shout home about, you know. I was decent at school in terms of, like, you know, but I was just too busy. School was social club, really.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Not that I condone it, and you know, but it just, I was very, very focused on wanting to be in music,
right?
And I used to do my mates' mixtapes. I used to stay up all night DJing, doing mixes at home, and used to bring in mixtapes at school, and that was like my currency at school, was sorting out people mixtapes and stuff.
No way. How much would you charge?
Well, I think it was a few dinner money runs, fish chips and curry sauce up the shop, nice. Up the shop up the top. I mean, you know, it was, yeah, I'd say there was a few bargains going, but that was and it was like, you know, exam results, and we were at dinner, and Mum's like, you know, you got to get a job. And my sister's friend, Darren, had a printer's, and I'd been to his place a couple of times, and he's like, oh, you know, you can come work for me doing an apprenticeship here and you know, see how it goes. And I, you know, that's what I was kind of going to do. And then Sarah, I'd been working on this EP for 6 months on a Fos Trax reel to reel and old school stuff. And
what production system did you use?
It was an S950 sampler. It was Pro 24 on an Atari ST with a MIDX interface going into a Fostex reel-to-reel machine and an old mixing desk. It was very, very simple and basic. But it was a labour of love, and it took me forever to make. And it's called the Sour Mash EP. It was actually named after, you know, me and my mate James were... shall we say, chilling out one evening, and it's on the side of a bottle of Jack Daniels. Hence the name of the EP. But it was like, she's like, why don't you start a record label? Mm. And I was like, what do you mean start a record label? Well, you could start a record label. How do you do that? What should we call it? So we're literally having dinner, and she's like, well, you know, I'm thinking up all these silly names. And she's like, you know, you're an Aries, Ram.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we're thinking about all the things, and that's where the name Ram comes from, because I'm an Aries. And she's like, yeah, I've got a great idea for the logo. And she sat down with a felt tip pen and hand drew the logo.
No way.
At the dinner table. And then she got a bit of A4 and did it neater. And then I looked in the yellow pages under printers.
Right.
Found printers, and then found the first one that said, and record label print, you know, because it used to have the description.
Wow.
Before Google.
Right.
You know, of course.
Yeah.
It used to have the description of what they would do. And one of them, Corda print, something like that, had the, in brackets, record labels. So I was like, well, they've got to be my guys. So I rang them up and I was like, what have I got to do? And they're like, right, so we need, put it all in a hardbacked envelope, tell us what you want. And so we wrote, Sarah drew the logo, which would become the Ram logo for a good many years. And on the other side, we mocked up the label, and Ram 001, Sour Mash EP, is exactly what we mocked up that day, but a little bit neater and tidier.
Right.
And sent it off.
So is this the logo which was Ram with the A with the horns, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So before I start asking you many questions about everything you've just said, can you introduce your first track?
Well, said track at that engagement party in Essex. It's actually funny, like that, you know, We Are Festival.
Yes.
Which I'm
in Birmingham, right?
No.
That's made.
Yeah, we Are is in
Essex. Yes, it is.
Literally a stone's throw from this. And I've had the privilege of playing it for the past few years.
Yeah.
To a slightly bigger audience that were in this bar that night, but it's a beautiful full circle that I now go and like play on like a main stage at this huge, huge festival, like 60,000, I don't know, crazy. But anyway, many, many moons ago, when I was 13, me and my mate James, my sister, took us to this engagement party in a barn in Essex, and this was the tune that blew my mind that night, and this is Young MC and Know How.
The busiest rhymes ever made by man are going into this mic written by this hand, are coming out of this mouth made by this tongue. I tell you now, my man, my name is Young, but so you think that it's your destiny to get the best of me, but
I remember, like, you know, talking to Brian G, and he's like, yo, what are you going to call yourself? And I was like tinkering around with different names. I was always going to be Ronnie.
Why Ronnie?
Well, Ronnie was some, like, there was a film called Babylon, and there was a guy in there called Ronnie. And I don't know, it just resonated with me, like, Ronnie! It was always something easy to, something to scream. It always just resonated well. But then it was like the size. And that's got an original story, because I used to hang out with a friend of mine, and we used to always go out to gigs and looking look for a girl or whatever. And you say, what about that girl? I'm like, nah, she's too tall. He said, oh, what about that girl? I'm like, nah, she's too small. I said, what about that girl there? Yeah, she's Ronnie size. So that's kind of how the name kind of...
Okay.
So it was like, it was a bit of a, like a dating game kind of...
I love that.
...kind of vibe. So it was like, it was, you know, and it was honest and truthful, but yeah.
So I don't know about your producing... And your creative processes and where it all started for you and how your production has changed over the years in terms of what you use and whether it's kind of gone to digital now or and how you kind of got started started back in the day? Was it through Crust and Die and people like that?
Well, you know, we kind of all came, we're all cut from the same cloth.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the day, to have a studio, you had to have money. And it, as simple as that. And if you didn't have money, then you couldn't buy Graham, just buy a desk and a sampler. So you had to kind of know someone who had the equipment. And I was quite lucky. I knew a couple of people that had studio setups who allowed me to be able to go in there and to you know, twiddle about with their equipment. And then I had two brothers. One was into hip-hop and into breakdancing. And he had a set of 1200s, Technics 1200s.
And
an old-school realistic mixer. And then I had another brother who was more into reggae and sound system. So, and
influenced by both.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of my brothers started buying studio equipment. Just bit by bit, bought a drum machine, and then we bought a sampler, then we bought, you know, just a desk. You know, it took months to save up to buy this equipment.
I bet.
Was really difficult to you know, to go out and to buy something. It cost, you know, a shitload of money back then to buy a sampler. And samplers wasn't even out. There was like a few that was floating around. But then I met two guys, these two guys called Paul and Andy. And they had like the whole kit and caboodle.
Wow.
They had like studio set up. It was great. They were actually responsible for writing the first Spice Girls album.
Wow.
So these guys, Paul and Andy, they're called, from a group called Absolute. That's what they went by.
Rings a bell, actually.
But they were used to work for Rhythm King. And when Rhythm King folded, Brian G used to work there as well. And Paul and Andy gave my tapes to Brian G.
So is Brian a Bristol boy then?
Brian's a London boy.
Right.
But he comes from Gloucester.
Okay.
But when Rhythm King folded, Brian G took the tapes and my phone number was written on the tape. So Brian G called me
up and then
came down to Bristol. And that's kind of like how we kind of all got together. But
is that literally it? He took over Rhythm King, was it?
So Rhythm King folded.
Right. Was that a label then?
It was a label back in the day. And he just took the tapes with him, which Paul and Andy, who I was making tunes with, and then basically just gave me a phone call and then came down to Bristol. So
no way. And it was just by chance of that Brian had read your number on the back of one of your tapes.
Exactly that. You know,
and he
was into the music, but me and Crust and Die and stuff, we were all like floating around different studios, just trying to just, you know, just learn the knowledge about how to make the music, you know.
Work experience.
Just, you know, we go into shops basically on, like, even in Bristol, you just go into a shop and just mess around on the drum machine for a couple of hours.
Yeah. So Brian gives you a call. What's he say?
Because, yeah, I love your tunes, man. I'm going to come down to Bristol. Yeah, that's my Brian G impression.
Right, that's quite good.
You know, and we saw his name on flyers. And then he had this idea that he wanted to start a label. Him and Jumpin' Jack Frost wanted to start a record label called Vinyl Experience.
Everyone talks about Jumpin' Jack Frost.
That's right. And that's when it became V Recordings. And
So was Jungle in its kind of like strong kind of era at that time? Or was it still developing as a genre?
It was still developing. I don't even think the name was, you know, it was still being flicked around from jungle techno to hardcore.
Right.
To
because I heard kind of hardcore was the first sort of genre to come out of the UK in terms of like electronic dance music. Is that fair to say, in terms of like from acid house it would then go into hardcore and then kind of make a progression out there?
It was you know, everyone's going to have their own different story. Like London will have their story about how it started for them. The Southwest will have their story. Manchester and the North will have their story.
Mm-hmm.
So it changes for everyone.
Right.
So for me to actually like try to pinpoint exactly, you know, what it was, it's like I can't do that. But for me, I remember when it changed from being jungle into drum and bass, because I just remember it, the rhythm changed when the rhythm was being really sporadic and the breaks were everywhere and bass lines were like, you know, amens were lashing and all these sounds were flying everywhere and it was like, you know, all these effects on keyboards and time stretching.
Yeah,
then all of a sudden it was like It's like, actually, you know, I mean, this rain is in a little bit. And then
it was a bit more regimental.
And that's when the beat, the two-step beat came in.
Right.
It was like the first, like, the boom, ket, boom, ket, boom, yeah. ket. And that's when, for me, personally, it changed from being jungle
right.
into being drum and bass.
Right.
That's just me personally.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really a sound. It was a time.
Right.
It was an era. And I just remember, like, between 93, maybe, and 92, 93, you know, and it was, you know.
Wow, is that when it happened?
It's the MCs, man. It's like the MCs have to take full credit because they would have to make up stuff on the spot. So you had all the MCs on stage, you know what I mean? And they would always, like, name check you, and they'd always say, yeah, it's the sound of jungle, or it's the sound, listen to the sounds of the drum and the bass. And,
yeah.
you know, so, you know.
Wow, that's really interesting, man.
Yeah, so, it's like, you know, for me, I remember being in the crowd.
That's quite, so what, you were actually raving at that point when the crossover from jungle to drum and bass, or as in, because I think jungle's obviously its own genre in itself, but when kind of drum and bass was born out of jungle?
Yeah, I kind of, you know, I remember when there were no names for the music, it was just... It's just what it was. It was just
uh-huh.
it was just rolling breaks. It was, you know,
no.
people were looking for a name. They were looking for, you know, for a tag. And then, you know, you just run with whatever's happening. You know what I mean?
So, no way. That's so interesting.
But that's my version.
Right.
Everyone has their own version, their own interpretation.
Right.
And for me, my interpretation is when it turned into, you know, like now, it's like you have so many names. It's great. It's exciting.
Yeah, there's so many subgenres and other genres and liquid drum and bass and tech and neurofunk. And
they're all relevant.
Yeah.
Because like people need to have something to be able to say, this is when I got into the music. You know
right.
what I mean? It's like, I remember when it was darkcore. And it was like basically taking anything from
dark core. Oh right, dark core.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Don't get that twisted.
Dark core.
Yeah. So they would take samples from horror films.
Really? Is
yeah,
that why they call it dark core?
Yeah. There was like, you know, there was like
no way.
They take all these horror movie samples, and it was great. The music was fantastic. Ricky. There's all these tunes from back in the day, like brilliant. But record labels like Third Party, and obviously people like Omni Trio and those guys. You know what I mean? They were making some great music on Moving Shadow, was
yeah.
an amazing label.
So did you feel like if you kind of were around for the kind of birth of that kind of drum and bass, especially the drum and bass beat, did it feel like there was something new coming within the ravers? Did the atmosphere feel like there was something new coming in, and there was a new wave of basically history being created? Did it feel like that at the time?
I think at the time people were just so excited. We used to go to Music House,
yeah,
and you know, you could hear everyone's tunes at Music House. It's a small place in Holloway Road.
Would you be lining up? And
yeah,
then,
exactly.
Andy,
waiting for your time.
Yeah, Andy said exactly the same thing.
Waiting for your time in that queue.
Yeah.
And like, you know, you would hear everyone's music. You would hear people's tunes. That's where, you know, you had to go in there and you play your music and everyone would hear it. And
right.
it was a special time. You'd be wait 9 hours just to cut one dub plate.
That's
and that's not
Andy
even
said.
No jokes. I can't even lie about it. Dude, I could have gone to New York and back in the time that I waited for dub plates to be cut. Do you know what I mean? But it's like, it's an old place, Music House, fantastic. And they mainly cut reggae records.
Oh, is that right?
And that's where I met Rodigan. Like, David Rodigan is a G.
Right.
He must be the most sampled guy in jungle. You know what I mean? His voice is being used on every single record. But he, for me, has a mad relevance because he was the first record that I ever heard. He played the first ever digital reggae rhythm. So it was like a tune called Sleng Tang. You know, David Rodigan on his ones went to Jamaica and had this amazing sound clash with this guy called Barry G. This white guy just went to Jamaica and just tore down the place
yeah.
with this one rhythm, Sleng Tang. And he just drew one after another. And that's when the sound clash was sound clash.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is something that is, if you can ever get a copy of the tape, you should check out The Clash. It's the most amazing Clash you'll ever hear. But this one tune is the first digital reggae rhythm Wayne Smith sang. Yeah, we should play. We should hear this tune, man.
Yes, please. The reason why I've wanted to speak to you is because of this, because of the whole Ibiza Classics tour. And it's, what, the fourth year now?
Yeah.
And I remember going to see the show, the first show, right, at the O2, and being slightly dazed and in my own world, let's say. I remember saying to the people I was with, I need to be doing that show.
Right.
And I won't stop until I'm doing that show. And he was like, you will be next year.
Right.
And lo and behold, we were. Mainly because I think I told my management to beg you for a slot on that show. So, but before we get into this, I think...
Well, happy we did.
Yeah, me too.
Now you're not leaving.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to buy a triangle for next year. Yeah, yeah. That's my part. So I think before I get on to, I mean, I have so many questions for you. But before that, I think, can you tell me what initially started to make you fall in love with DJing when you were a kid?
I just always wanted to be involved in music. I love music. I started banging things when I was a kid, so I'm told by my parents. They got me a drum kit super young, and then at school I was in a band, bad heavy metal band, and I used to sit in my front room just listening to kind of like T-Rex and Deep Purple and like old rock bands, The Who. And then at a school disco one year, I saw a DJ for the first time in my life, like literally two turntables and an old amplifier stuck in between playing somebody else's music, and it just made a lot more of a better noise kind of thing. And it was an instant kind of love affair with the idea of playing other people's music to people.
Was it always dance music you wanted to do?
Well, no, at the beginning, like super early, it was like the pop music of the day, because I was doing kind of school, I did literally took over the school disco. And then I gravitated quite quickly into things that were kind of funky or danceable. Yeah. So, pre-disco, disco, and just, dance records back in the day. So it was like KC and the Sunshine Band. My dad was quite a big record buyer. So he would, occasionally we'd get these American kind of funk records and stuff like that.
Right.
So it was like anything you could dance to. So, and hence then getting into James Brown and Parliament and Funkadelic and stuff like that. So,
do you still play those records now?
Very, very rarely, at some kind of exceptional circumstance. Probably last time I played a record like that was, I did a thing with, I'm just trying to think, it was with Rob the Bank, actually, on a beach in Ibiza, probably about 15, 20 years ago, where we just decided to play a 7-inch set. So I had to bring 7 inches out. So,
Wow.
But I mean, I got asked to do a vinyl set this year, and I did it in Miami. And it was my vinyl had been in storage for a long, long time, like years and years and years. It was the collection was too big to ever get out in my house, and it was just too heavy. So it had been locked up in storage, and for years I thought I should have sold some of it or whatever, but I kept it. And then when we went to kind of unpack it and start to organize it, because I knew this vinyl set was coming up, I found out that one of the units, the records in, got flooded, and I lost a lot of the 7 inches, actually.
Oh no.
So I got they're now in Bethnal Green in a one of these units, like a shipping container.
Yeah.
And it's all got shelves inside. I'm not telling anyone where it is. Bethnal Green. And near Dizzy Rascal's house. So
work it out from there.
Yeah. But yeah, so I've got it all racked out again, and I was able to do this vinyl set, and it was a lot of fun. So it was going back kind of physical records and stuff like that.
Yeah. Did your dad take you record shopping a lot then? Was it your dad?
No, not really. I mean, only into there was a local record store in Gravesend that was pretty cool, and they did the crowd that I grew up around were quite savvy to you call it underground music of the day. So it was like funk and soul records, jazz funk records, reggae records. Mm. And they would go up to London and come back down with different records and stuff like that. And this record shop tried to get in on that and be part of that and stock a certain, try to specialise in a certain type of music. And I got a part-time job in there, actually, because I just loved, the idea of in the old days of a record store, the sleeve would sit out in the shop and the record would be filed on a shelf in a container a sleeve, another sleeve. And then if someone wanted to buy the record, they'd bring the sleeve to the counter, the till, and then you'd have to go and get the record and put it in the thing. It was like antiquated. But that's what you had to do. And I loved the whole process of kind of cataloguing records, and I was a train spotter.
Yeah, I feel like it was a lot more special, I suppose, back in the day.
Well, I think just seeking out records, it was a mission. Yeah. It was an absolute mission. And it was the it was the making of you as a DJ in terms of how you the kind of records you found and the records you bought. And that told everything about you was how, back in the day, we'd get records and cover up the labels, and put, like, I'd literally sit on my kitchen table and cut out a white circle and then physically stick it on top of the label and then write something different on it. So that obviously when people came to the DJ booth and they asked what the record is, they couldn't find out what it was.
Really?
So we did all of that.
How sneaky.
Yeah.
Was that how competitive it was back in the day then?
Super competitive in the kind of old soul and jazz funk scene, yeah.
Right.
And then, it was definitely a mission to get records. It was, it was mail order. You used to get these magazines that used to write about the music, and then record shops in the back would have these really train-spottery like ads that was just like endless type of like all these different titles. So then you'd have to like send off a check to the record shop, and get it mailed to you. So it was
check, man.
And then, or you'd have to go up, and then eventually I started going up to London and visiting all the hot record shops. And then you have to build your reputation with the person behind the counter that you become the one that they want us, they didn't want to just sell the records to anyone. So, if you were just Joe,
no way,
blogs off the street, if they only had 5 copies of something, then you weren't going to get one of those.
Right.
You had to be someone to get one. So I had to work my way up through all of the hierarchy of that. And there was 2 shops in particular that I got. There was Groove Records, which is around the corner from here, in Greek Street, long gone. And then there was one in Holborn called City Sounds on Proctor Street. And I got to the top of the tree of both of those stores. And at City Sounds, I would literally be there when the boxes came in from America, and then we'd open up the boxes, and they would almost give me the records to check and find out which were the hot ones were. And so I got right to the top of the front of the process.
How long did that take you, do you reckon?
A few years to get to that, yeah.
Damn. But, and what did that entail then? Did that entail going around to the clubs in the local area and kind of making your name out on the dance floor, and then being able to return to the record shops?
Yeah, it was kind of working my way into a gang. There was a kind of a soul mafia back in the day that was a group of DJs that were kind of the biggest DJs on the scene. And it all, the specialist soul scene was in London, but it was also in all the home counties. You're talking about the kind of late 70s going into the early 80s.
Yeah.
And the way I was the kind of young whippersnapper, like I was probably 10 years younger maybe than all these guys, maybe a bit more with a couple of them. And I just started running clubs in Kent and then booking them to come and play for me. And then eventually they got to know me, and then I started to get booked to play with them at their clubs in, Essex or London or whatever. And I built my way into the scene like that. And then they used to hold these all-dayers and like these special one-off events at kind of bank holidays and Christmas or whatever. And I started to appear on the bill of those parties. So, and work my way up. And then
work
my way into it.
Do you think it was more of a thing of like, you kind of knew these guys, but you were holding your own parties?
Yeah.
And totally, wanted to book them for your own parties. And then it was a kind of respect thing of like, oh, it's Pete. He's not only DJing, but he's booking his own parties.
Yeah, back in the day, it was very much about, as much as about the music you played, it was about, having something going on. So being entrepreneurial enough. What made you hot is if you had a hot club or a hot club night or a crowd that went with you. So I was building that up big time in Kent.
Yeah. No way.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about your track that you've chosen. One Nation Under a Groove by Funkadelic, 1978. I'm guessing this was kind of like the anthem of your DJ sets then back in...
It was in the first phase of me making my name as a DJ. It was like the kind of ultimate funk party record. It was a brilliant record. It's Bootsy Collins. He was part of Parliament, but he broke off and did his own thing as Funkadelic. And it's kind of timeless. I mean, it's been sampled a million times and it's like had a profound influence on, you know, hip-hop and urban music and people like Pharrell and... all the greats, basically. Mm. And it's just still sounds as good today. And it's probably as difficult to probably figure out how it actually got made as well. But yeah, brilliant piece of music, One Nation Under a Groove, and it's still with a great message.
Well, here it is.
Ready or not, here we come, getting down on.
Sister Bliss, welcome and thank you for joining me. I want to know, I think what I'd like to start with your talents on instruments. When did you start learning piano? Because you can play bass guitar, piano, violin and the saxophone. Am I correct in saying that?
I can. But I mean, having said that, I haven't picked them up for like, well, I play keyboards all the time, but I haven't picked up the other instruments for probably a good 15 odd years. But yeah, I wanted to be Prince, basically. I think we probably all do.
Oh, thank you.
We just want to do everything. And I would teach myself instruments.
It was never a thing that your parents kind of...
No, put. I was very lucky because my dad was a jazz musician. He still plays, actually. He plays saxophone and piano. So those instruments were in my house. So I begged to learn the piano and I learned since I was 5 years old. I begged and nagged and nagged and nagged and nagged until they got me piano lessons. And then I had a friend who played the violin, so I wanted to do what she did. So then I picked that up when I was about 8. And then I taught myself the flute and then started having lessons.
Wow.
And then my dad was in a band with a bloke called Frank, and Frank left his bass around our house. So I just picked it up and taught myself bass. I was in a band playing bass really badly. You know, please don't think there was anything kind of virtuoso about any of it. But it enabled me to make house music. So I'm very thankful. And I kind of hear instrumentation in my head, which is kind of how I write. But now all instruments come through keyboard for me. And if we need guitar or we work with other musicians on our records, we get them in. We don't rely on me doing things really badly. You know, we have paid string sections to do beautiful orchestral passages on some of our albums. It wouldn't be me scraping away. I don't even know if my violin works anymore. It was under my mum's bed for, well, probably about another 15 years gathering dust.
Is it your violin playing on Salva Mia?
No, I think that was a keyboard. We did it on a keyboard, played everything on a keyboard.
It's just the lies that we tell on Logic, right?
I know, but you know, when they keep giving us these amazing string sections from orchestras, it's amazing. And it's very cost effective as well. Let's be honest, it's not cheap hiring.
I was about to say that, yeah. So when did you first fall in love with dance music?
When I first heard it, I'd always loved synthesizers. I'd always loved, which is probably going to lead us to one of the tunes that I've picked as my special meaningful record today.
trying to be professional.
You're leading me right there. Right through the 80s, I loved all of synth pop. Anything that had synthesizers in it, I was absolutely fascinated with because it just sounded like another world. Mm. And when I first started going out clubbing, it was like to 50s and 60s nights at Camden Palace. And then I discovered with a friend of mine this gay bar in King's Cross, which weirdly enough is also mentioned in Bernardine Evaristo's amazing book, Girl, Woman, Other. If you haven't read it, you must. And it's a place called The Bell. It's now become the Big Chill Bar. just on Pentonville Road.
Yes, I know.
And it used to have the most rocking nights there. And they'd play everything like Madonna, Prince, 12 Inches, Iggy Pop. And then you'd hear this record that sounded like it came from Mars. And it was very early house music. So that was like 1987, 88. I just couldn't get enough of it. And then I discovered pirate radio and an underground mad warehouse parties, basically. And it really wasn't at all mainstream, this music. You could not hear it anywhere. It was so buried. And that was it. I was just smitten with all of it. And then, a couple of years after that, I met a guy in a Camden market, and he sold me my first Atari and a crack copy of a computer program called Cubase. And I taught myself how to make a tune on Atari, a little cassette and a little synthesizer. My dad had synthesizers in the house from when I was a kid because he used to use them to play his jazz on. And that was it. I started making demos, just sat there making dance music on my own. And then I met a guy in a record shop because I was also DJing at the time. And he said, my friend's a producer. Why don't we make a tune together? So we went to watch Blade Runner. And very inspired, and we wrote a little tune in my mum's bedroom. And that friend, that mutual friend, was Rollo, and he ended up producing our very first record. And that was in, 91, 92. That was about then. So that was a very, very compressed version of the history. And the very same friend also introduced us to Maxi. A couple of years later, he said, oh, I've met a Buddhist rapper, because he was going out with a girl from Brixton, and this girl was a friend of Maxie's. So Ben brought this guy to our studio, introduced us, and we just got talking about his philosophy and his agenda and his lyrics, and we made Salva Meir together. And that was the first ever Faithless record we made, because it had a bit that we found a button on the Atari that slowed down to a hip-hop beat, and we're like, we've done this house record and we want it to slow down in the middle, but we need like a rap to go over it. And Rollo asked Maxi, after we talked for ages about what Buddhism meant and, you know, what his religion meant to him, his faith, and he decided to call the project Faithless, and he asked Maxi to write lyrics about feeling so frustrated in his own skin that he couldn't bear to live, really, which is quite sort of dark as a subject matter in dance music. And Maxi absolutely rose to the occasion, and he'd spoke about not having any faith in himself, and just below my skin I'm screaming was the kind of hook, if you like, for Salva Meir. And it was a very, very uncompromising record, and you probably couldn't dance to it, but we were very proud of it. So that was the very beginning.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
That's fascinating. Do you feel like there's a level of darkness that you could have got away with back then over dance music that you can't necessarily get away with now? I always feel like there's a pressure to, especially writing dance music, although I definitely write on more of the commercial side, but that there is a pressure to be happy on the dance floor. And I definitely try and write sad songs on the dance floor, but never necessarily of any kind of weight or heaviness. And I found that growing up, I found that there was a darkness that was incorporated in the 90s dance music that isn't necessarily something that you can get to now.
I think it all depends on the artist and what they want to say. I think the great thing about dance music, it's very forgiving as a genre, and it seems to be incredibly inclusive, from sort of, you know, very uplifting sort of Brazilian house to very minimal to really banging aggressive techno to dubstep to drum and bass. You know, within dance music, it's such a widespread of genres. I think there's always been a space for a message. You know, if you think it was kind of born of Black, gay, Hispanic, you know, outcast communities trying to find somewhere to come together, you know, where they weren't persecuted. And a lot of those early house records are very uplifting, but there is a melancholy that runs through them because they're about survival as well.
Yeah.
So I always feel, for me, there is this sort of deep emotional core in dance music. Not everybody's explicit with it, but one of the records I've chosen again today, for me, is one of the records that gave us permission, if you like, to visit that darker territory that, you know, the human experience isn't just about escapism and joy and mindless hedonism. There is a, you know,
connectivity, a deeper meaning about it, right?
Yeah, but there's also deeper meaning, and we can look in the dark corners as well, especially if you've got someone who is such a kind of sensitive narrator and poet like Maxi at the helm. I think he did it in a way that wasn't cliched, but that was very relatable. But also, we had context, and the context was not just the dance floor and the clubs. It was the fact that we were making an album. So it changes how you're listening to music, and perhaps you can, if you like, get away with having a deeper, darker message if you have a whole album to ingest and you know, carries you, as they say, musical cliche, on a journey, which I do believe we do want to do with our records. But we create a space where we can explore all the sort of corners of the human psyche, whether very joyous, uplifting, euphoric, but or with a melancholy undercurrent, or about relationships falling apart. That's the great thing about an album. You can go to all of those places, you know, heartbreak, pain, joy, on a kind of 50-minute trip. So I think we were very blessed knowing that we didn't just want to do one track. We wanted to make an album.
So which track of yours was inspiring around that time that you mentioned then?
In terms of music feeling like it could be a revolution, like a call to revolution, and maybe angry and looking at the dark side, Left Fields Open Up. It's an amazing record because they enlisted John Lydon from the Sex Pistols as a vocalist. And you think, what an unlikely pairing, a kind of, you know, British techno slash house band who had a really eclectic vibe as well, bringing in this punk icon. And I'd say it's probably one of the best vocals he's ever done. And it still stands up today. It's an amazing record. It's like
sounds
a call
super
to
fresh.
Arms. And it is angry. And it was exciting. And when you heard that drop on the dance floor, you were like, oh my God. God.
Yeah.
But you've also got to remember that Left Field made Leftism, which I would say without that album, there wouldn't be a Faithless. That, if you like, allowed us to believe that dance music could live on an album format and be, you know, really valid and really enjoyable in a way that maybe just a dance compilation wasn't. Because there's definitely a trend for, in that period, that people have recognised people want a compilation, like a mixtape of all their favourite tunes. And Left Field did a whole album that went all over the place musically, yet still sounded like one thing. So that was a powerful template, I'd say. But, you know, subconsciously and maybe consciously as well.
Well, let's hear it. This is Left Field, Open Up. Guests today are Fabio and Groove Rider. What were you using if you weren't using what turntables, the techniques that you had
old
to...
Old school belt-driven turntables.
Oh, we used to get Garrard. It was Garrard.
Oh, I don't know what they were called.
Yeah, we used to... They were literally...
They were all the same basis. It just belt drives, which is a whole different mechanism. So they were actually like bits of rubber that was making the...
For real. And when they used to start the tune, they used to slur.
Yeah.
They used to just go, and then it used to start every single tune. That's like, how we
like
started.
Like a gram, you know, remember grams? You know what grams are?
No, she's literally
she's 90s, baby.
Yeah, 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 you know what I'm saying? Go to the Natural History Museum. They've got
you might see that in there, yeah.
But yeah, it was, that's how we started. So when techniques came along, man, that was that was another thing that was a massive
yeah,
danger.
I mean, like, you have to remember these things cost a load of dough. Yeah. We weren't rich guys.
Yeah, yeah,
so
for real.
To even use them, oh, we had to be playing out in yeah clubs.
So what would you practice on?
You didn't.
You didn't.
You didn't
practice when you went to a club. You weird literally practiced when you went to a nightclub.
Went,
that was
it. Yeah, it's all live,
we couldn't afford. Technique were, they've held their price. I mean, they were like a lot of money.
A lot of money back
a
then.
A lot of money.
So because you were DJing the sound, did you find that other producers were coming up to you with the sound that you were trying to create in a track?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Do you?
Yeah, yeah, that's what happened.
That's exactly what happened.
Right. Okay, cool.
You know, what happened then was after WIE, then we had, guys like Paul Ibifa and this label called Living Dream and Moving Shadow. Then they all started to make it because we were championing this stuff at Rage. That's what we were doing. You know, we kind of like, you know, gravitated more towards this sound. Yeah. Because you've got to remember, Rage was a house club. It was a purist house club,
yeah,
as well, on the main floor. And we came and
transitioned it.
Completely changed the vibe in there. I don't think that would ever happen now. No. I don't think that would ever happen. I don't think no one would take a risk like that. It was a real massive risk what they took.
To hear a new sound being played in the club and go home and try and make that so that you guys had a...
No, it's not even,
not even that.
But being in an actual house club and changing it to a drums club.
Yeah,
you know,
it was a massive thing. Cause Rage was like, what the original Rage was, they were trying to get the whole vibe of Paradise Garage from New York. They were trying to get this whole New York real garagey sound, lots of vocals. And he completely done a U-turn, got us in there playing some ghetto shit.
Yeah,
that's
ghetto
what we
house
were doing,
yeah,
and experimenting.
Techno.
We were playing techno, we were experimenting with breakbeats, we were playing
everything.
Not the kind of house that was being played in there before.
Right, you know, I see. So it was a risk for the promoters to have you guys
risk
there.
And right. I remember him saying to us that, you know, the old purists weren't happy with the way everything was going, but it was rammed in there, so...
Yeah, numbers don't lie, man.
What's he going to do? Numbers don't lie, as you said. And,
and
we were smashing it. We were literally smashing it every single week.
We didn't go to the main floor for a couple of years. We was just being tested upstairs. But what happened?
Yeah, I saw this in your in the documentary yesterday.
Yeah, we were just backup DJs, basically. We was just hosting the room too. So,
and there's too many people upstairs.
Yeah, too many people upstairs.
That must have been cool as fuck, man. That must have been such a nice, like, oh shit, we're onto something real big here.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
we're
exactly
doing something great. It must have been amazing to kind of.
It's like an apprenticeship, man. We just smashed it.
Yeah,
we didn't even know. I mean, I don't look at stuff like that, but we just saw people there dancing. That's all we ever look. That's all I ever care about. I didn't think about the numbers downstairs or if we were going to get promoted or anything like that. I didn't think of any of that.
Yeah.
Just the vibe.
Just the vibe, man.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Just being happy to play music on a Thursday night.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Rage. I don't want to go too much into Rage, as I said, because you guys have a documentary that people can watch and you've done the hard work for me on Rage.
We've spoken about it a lot.
Well... I'd like to know, in your opinion, what made Rage so unique and influential, even in places like Chicago?
It's because we just didn't give a shit, basically. We just, like, played music. You have to remember, a lot of people follow scripts, man. We didn't follow any scripts.
Mm.
You know, we just played what was new, what was fresh, what the new sound was every single week. You know, we hunted to tunes, you know what I'm saying? It wasn't no... Oh, you're going to come in there and you're going to hear a load of anthems. Yo, we didn't deal with that, man. We just, like, kept rolling out, hunting, fresh.
It was an experiment that paid off. They don't always pay off.
No,
you know what I'm saying? And someone taking a risk like that, that's why it's worth taking risk, because he took a massive risk.
Massive.
He could have lost everything, and he took a huge risk on us, and it paid off.
Yeah.
And I think that... The payoff was worth it because...
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he had all kinds of organisations that led out of Rage. Dance 91, Dance This. He had loads of things, spin-offs of Rage and know, it made him, man.
But, you know, the thing is as well, we had no idea. That's another thing, Becky, you've got to remember. We didn't have any idea what was going on. Like, it's only until since the last couple of years everyone's been talking about Rage that it's really hit home what we did there.
It was.
Yeah.
Because we've always moved on. We've never been old school DJs. We've never looked back ever. We've never, ever done that. So you've got this thing as well where you're just working constantly. So you've got no time to look back and sit there and think, you know what? Oh, fucking Rage was amazing. Because you're thinking about your next gig.
Rage was like when it was.
It was when it was. It was a long time ago. So until this, everyone, you know, started talking about it now, and it's gained a lot of traction with everyone kind of like, you know, realizing it was the birth of Jungle. We've never really sat back and processed anything.
You don't sit there and pat ourselves on the back thinking, yeah,
we did this and that.
That was last year, man. You know, what are we going to do next year?
The future's always a lot more important.
How did you find the 30 years of Rage reunion in terms of, because it was all the same lineup, right? It was all the old school DJs from back in day.
Yeah.
And it looked like a proper, like,
there were a lot of hairlines missing.
A lot of teeth missing. It's true.
Two bulges here and there. Yeah. Generally, it was pretty
much true, though, you know. It's so much things that we saw from the past, right?
Yeah.
I was going, you don't look any different. And I'm thinking, well,
you can't see it.
But yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing to see, because we had what was great, a lot of the people from even the early Acid House days turned up.
Yeah.
And we saw people that we haven't seen for 30-odd years.
Yeah, some of the old-time ravers.
You know, they all came down.
A lot of industry people there as well that actually didn't, you know, weren't at Rage, but heard about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So they got to come down to experience the music that was played at that time.
So it was amazing. It really was amazing. You know, we were really worried because, you know, you do these things, you never know.
Yeah,
but having it back in heavens was really important.
That's
it was a massive thing, and you know, having it back in heavens was made it feel like Rage,
authentic.
It really made it feel authentic, man.
So one of the songs that was taken off the Rage album was Champion Sound Key Project, and it features quite predominantly in the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening out for a song I could pick for the podcast, and I was watching that last night, and I was like, oh, this one's fucking sick. I'm gonna just send this one. And I was like, shit, they picked it. So tell me a bit about this song.
Oh, it's an amazing tune, man. It's not aged. You know, some of these tunes are not aged well. You know, some of them, you know, you can't really play them anymore. But like Terminator, these tunes are timeless. They really are. And Champion Sound still got that vibe. It still sounds relevant. And it's a very simple tune. But the stabs in it are just great. It's so well produced, and it's just got that energy.
Especially for that time, man.
Yeah, man, for real. Yeah.
One of the early jungle records, right?
Yeah, man. That used to tear up the dance, man. And it still does. You play a jungle, so you play Put That On, you know that. It's Passport Tune. You can't go wrong. Passport Tune, man. So
Passport Tune.
Tune you can play anywhere.
Yeah. Come on, you should have figured that one out. That wasn't difficult, Becky.
Right, let's listen to this Passport Tune. It's Passport where I'm from. This is Champion Sound, Q Project. Today are Groove Armada. How long have you two... So you were both going to New York together to DJ?
I think so.
We were.
How long had you been together for this point? How long had you been DJing together?
This must have been like... it was the very beginning of the Jive Records era, so it must have been like 98, something like that. So probably year two or three, I guess.
Wow. You can definitely hear from these songs that you've chosen how they have influenced... You guys, I mean, it's quite amazing, really. Let me take it back to your club night that you started. How easy was it to start that club night, and what was it like in a rave? What was it like when you were there?
Yeah, I mean, it was not... I mean, we both of us, I think, had DJed quite a bit before then. I mean, I was in... I'd been DJing quite a bit in Manchester, and I played a couple of times in a Hacienda, which was amazing, and I had was a resident at a place called Head Funk for a year. So we both DJed, and Andy had done loads of stuff himself up north and when he was at college. So... like, and he said it was just hard to get the work when we came back into London with so much stuff going on. So they were more like, they were really parties to bring together just groups of friends, you know, and it was really, really, we're relying on our, just our crowd to come. And then it kind of got a bit more ambitious, probably too ambitious. We're a bit like Icarus, you know, we sort of flew to the moon and got up to the sun and got burned quite badly. We set up a night. What was the name of that venue, Andy, where we did for the Dave Seaman night?
It was the Gardening Club too.
So yeah, we overstretched ourselves that night, didn't we? And we lost a ton of money. We booked Dave Seaman, which for us at the time was like, particularly for Andy, I think it was a big deal, you know. And we slightly overstretched ourselves there, didn't we? We lost a considerable amount of money then for ourselves in those days.
Considerable amount of money, that was the day after was the famous newspaper headline, because as we sort of had our fry up to see how we were going to plug the hole in the finances, the headline of the back page of the tabloids was Seaman Sinks Armada, which was quite amusing. That was referring to a football game between England and Spain, but it was quite an appropriate headline.
Well, and, I mean, all press is good press.
Yeah, and actually, in a weird sort of way, the good thing that came out of that was we realised that our future wasn't in club promotion. Although weirdly, like you say, we went back to then set up one of London's biggest festivals, but that came later. But that refocused our energies on wanting to write records and be DJs and to stay out of the organisational side of things, which is probably a good decision, you know.
Was it a difficult process going from DJing to writing? Or did that come naturally
I think Andy should answer that a bit more, because he'd been right. Andy was, I had never written... that's not untrue. I'd had one EP out with one band years ago, but I hadn't really committed much stuff to vinyl before I met Andy. So you'd had quite a lot of experience, Andy. You were remixing and writing and all sorts by then, weren't you?
Yeah, I'd had a couple of rave tunes out on a label called Rumour Records, and because I had a deal going in Wakefield where I grew up, where there was a rich kid whose dad had a snooker club, and his dad had bought him a recording studio. But he didn't know how to use any of it. So I had a deal with him where I would go down and help him write a tune, and then I got to use the studio for the rest of the night. Right. So using that deal, I'd managed to get a couple of tunes out on this Rumour Records thing, which was very exciting. And then I was living in a flat. When I met Tom, I was living in a flat in Clapham with two other lads, and we had a band called the Beat Foundation, and we've been doing some livey sort of dancey livey gigs, and we'd had a tune on Pete Tong, in fact, which was massive, and then massive for us anyway, and then we were actually just in the process of signing a deal with Virgin when it all started happening for me and Tom. And it was a very difficult conversation with my flatmates, with whom I've been struggling with for years, saying, lads, I'm afraid I'm going to have to roll with this one. That was not fun.
So you had just got a record deal with your old band, with your other band, and you and Tom had just started DJing together, and it was all kicking off for you two as well, making music together.
Yeah, and it just felt like, there was just a vibe of me and Tom making the tune. Because I think my first memory of making music together was it was all just a laugh. And to be honest, it's always remained that, in that Tom would come round with some records that he wanted to sample. I had a little basic setup in my bedroom in this flat in Clapham, so we'd mess about with that. And then we'd go out on the common and play a bit of football, because I'm shit and Tom's a really good football player. So we were having a kind of skill exchange. And that sort of spirit of just having a laugh and making music that we both think is great has remained the modus operandi ever since.
It's the best way to make music. When did you move down to London then? Did you move to London for uni?
94 for me.
And then what, the promoter? Was it the promoter that came up to you guys and told you should make to go away and make an album for it?
He was a guy called Tim Lee, who was he was called Tim Lovely, was his pseudonym. He's still out there. He's running a label called Tommy Touch. It's still going. But I was in a band when I was in a band in Cambridge called the Thumbsaurus People. He was in a band 2 years older than me called Bhagwan Fresh and the Gurus of Jive. And they were like my heroes. They were the guys I wanted to be. They used to wear caftans and play funk covers. They were brilliant. And then he set up this label in Shoreditch, which is a Shoreditch, which is unrecognizable from the Shoreditch you're in now, like a proper, like, you know, it's crawling in and out of strange brick walls and just a much madder, wilder place. He lived in this funny warehouse on Rivington Street, which is probably now almost certainly an estate agent's, but at the time was anything but that. And he ran that label. There were some people called the Idiot Boys were signed to that. A lot of acts from my hometown, from Cambridge, signed to that label. And all doing all right. There was a label called Newphonic around that time that was in the same sort of lane. And he sort of showed some belief in us and sent us off packing. And really, it was that making that album, which was Northern Star, which he did in a week, which... that was the one that had Out the River on it. And that was the one that it really happened really rapidly after that. Like, it's sort of when I think about from making that record, you know, Andy says two years later, we were in the Tunnel Club, you know, as sort of guests, up and coming UK DJs, part of an American label. It was very sudden. And it really was probably Out the River that kind of, you know, broke the floodgates for us, you know, and that tune. And Rob the Bank, who was the editor of Music Magazine at the time, picked up on that. Pressed a few sevens, and it was, I guess in those days it was a much simpler time, you know, there wasn't social media, there wasn't sort of SoundCloud or anything like that, so a lot of people didn't have access to technology the way they do now, so there was just less music about, and there's a small cabal, you know, of kind of A&R guys, and they were mainly guys, you know, who were signing records, so if you kind of knew the right people and you had some momentum, things could happen quite rapidly. So it happened really rapidly for us. We did that, we signed a label deal with Jive, like about 6 months later, went back into the studio, did Vertigo, which is our first sort of album that people are really aware of, and that's why I had ICU Baby on it, and If Ever at the Same. And then we were that summer, after that, we were in Ibiza, and then everything starts, you know, and then from there on in, it's like...
that
it's
really, quick?
Really rapid, yeah. So ICU Baby was written basically in the basement of Manumission, full of all these strippers, and it was a woman called Grandma Funk who was the hostess with the mostess, who was me and Andy used to DJ, and she'd get on the mic and do her bit, and that was her one night who started singing the ICU Baby lyrics. So everything happened really suddenly, and I guess we were quite good at, I think there's a lot of madness in that time, and a lot of it is about the people who were probably just about able to keep their shit together enough to kind of to actually get some stuff down are the ones that survived, you know. And I think we were like, when we were in Manumission, we were having a great time, don't get me wrong, but I think we were like, this is happening, we need to get back to studio, get this recorded, there's something happening here. And there's a lot of people that didn't quite have the self-control to get that stuff down, you know.
Right, I see. I can imagine. The drugs were much better back in the day, so I can see why. From what I've heard, anyway, that's really fascinating that you say that, because from what I've heard you talk about is that there are actually quite a lot of record deals going on. I mean, Andy was having about 5 different record deals by the sounds of things going on. and as you said, Tom, like a lot of people from Cambridge had been signed and all of that. Like from my perspective. Obviously, where I've come up from, you know, if you weren't in London, you didn't have much of a chance of getting a record deal. And it's fascinating that you say, actually, technology and being able to produce from your bedroom and do all that shit, like, that has actually made it a lot harder and saturated the market so much that people just don't get much notice, or you have to have a very, you know, it has to be fucking on TikTok with a million, 3 million streams or whatever. That's really fascinating that you talk about that. What do you think it was with At the River that kind of did all that for you?
Zoe Ball, mainly, I think. Bless her. It was Zoe Ball who was doing the breakfast show on Radio 1 at the time. I don't know. Oh, I think she presumably listened to it because there was a front cover of Music Magazine back in the days when magazines were, you know,
still a thing as well.
They're still a thing, yeah. So maybe that's why she listened to it. Anyway, she loved it. I think it went on to be a quite a big tune at her wedding to Norm. And she played it because they'd said that it was too slow for the radio, and but she kept playing it anyway. And then the response from the listeners was so positive that they eventually agreed to reconsider the playlist decision. But then there was a whole battle because they wanted to take the trombone out, and obviously without the trombone out, it's just a loop. So then we had to sort of fight that one. And anyway, eventually it ended up as part of the daytime playlist, which was quite amazing, really, considering what an odd tune it is. It's kind of a tribute to Radio 1 that eventually found its way on there.
Wow. I mean, I will talk about the river in a sec, but it's mad to me that over this podcast series, it's crazy to think how firstly, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that Radio tried to A&R your record for you and tell you which part to. I don't know what is Radio's problem, but they're Radio. They play records. They're not A&Rs. We've got enough fucking A&Rs in the world to keep us all from questioning what kind of frigging beat it is, what frequency is on the hi-hat, whatever. It annoys me that Radio has that sort of power, and fucking fair play to you guys for sticking to your guns with that. Because I kind of think without the trombone, it's half a song, right? So incredible that you guys pushed forward to it. I do feel like, and in a sense, that was kind of like a modern model where the track gained traction due to Zoe Ball playing it on her radio station, and then it getting onto Radio 1 playlist, and then having that crowd reaction. That's typically kind of how it works with Spotify and stuff, right? Now, so interesting with that. The reason why I picked At the River for my track is not only because when I was on tour with Pete Tong doing the Ibiza Classics, this song wasn't in the first year, and I don't think it was in the third year, but it was in the second year that I did the Classics with the Heritage Orchestra and Pete. And it was actually my favorite part of the set, because even though it was a little bit slower, people were still like, it was still a very euphoric thing for a lot of people. I also have earlier memories. What year was this released, by the way, out of interest?
Oh, good question.
97, I think.
Right.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
So I remember going on holiday with my parents and being in the back of the car. I don't know how old I was, but I remember, like, the memory makes me feel quite young. And I remember this song being played on the way to the seaside. I am going to shut up and play this because I can't wait to hear it. This is Groove Armada, At the River. Basement Jacks, Felix Buxton, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Hello, everybody out there in the world. Hope you're breathing, smiling, living, loving, because we're all alive and we've got to celebrate this life.
This is going to be a good podcast, I can tell. let me give you some background on my fandom and my fangirly moments of Basement Jacks. I remember my sister, my big sister, giving me her computer tower, probably back in 2005. So I'd have been 11, maybe 2004. And I remember she had bought Basement Jacks the singles. And that's where my love for Basement Jacks started. I remember listening to all of those tunes and knowing them all as well. It wasn't like any of them were like new to me, but it was like all of those songs that I'd heard over the last 10 years of being on this earth, kind of compiled into one amazing album. And then as I grew up, I think the album to do it for me was Scars back in 2009. And that was amazing for me because in 2009, I probably would have been about 15, 16. Can't do the maths. But I remember me and my friends listening to that. And
My favourite song on that was actually the Paloma Faith tune, What's a Girl Gotta Do?
Oh, yeah.
I just loved how... It was just something I'd never heard before in terms of... It was an actual song, but it was on a very different... Not like a pop production that you would ever hear, and I suppose mm-hmm. it wasn't. And then you had the Sam Sparrow stuff and all of that. I fucking loved that album. And obviously it's kind of been a wide spread of albums for you. Can you tell me where it all started for you and where you met Simon and how this kind of incredible sound all started?
Well, I came to London in 91. So basically I left school in 1988, which was the summer of love. Which was the time of Acid House. Musically, it was an amazing time. It was very open. House music was new. And it was, I remember in 1987, in the school break time, someone with a ghetto blaster playing a tape, cassette, and we all stood around, and it was House Nation. And that's what, which was the House Master Boys. And it sounded so fresh, and it was kind of, it was like a computer had gone wrong, and it just sounded like ridiculous, like a really different style of music, and that was really exciting. And so probably my love for dance music. Well, I don't know. I've always loved dance music. I used to love. All doing the okie-cokie, which is like, we all do the okie-cokie when I was 5 years old, probably. And I love Mozart and I love waltzes and Strauss and kind of gypsy music. And so I liked the Charleston and kind of 1930s music. I really like that. And probably because growing up, my dad was a vicar. And wow. So Sunday lunchtimes. After we'd all been to church and I'd sung in the choir, me and my two sisters. And then he'd put old-time musical music, which was on the radio at that time. And sometimes if it was really good and the spirit took him, he'd get up and start having a dance around. And yeah, so it was kind of, dancing was quite natural. And it was kind of, yeah, him and my mum met at the Young Farmers dancing together. So it's kind of like, yeah.
That's so cute. That's how I suppose it was back in the day before all this horrible dating stuff that's online and Tinder
exactly.
And all
it was
of that.
Very, yeah, I mean, he said he saw her when he was 14 and he thought, oh, that's my wife, that's fine. So, but he thought, leave it a few... He was quite a mature kid, I think. and then a few years later, anyway, that's by the by. But... So my love of dance music, it was probably when I was first going out dancing when I was 17, and I learned to drive. I lived in the Midlands, and
you're East Midlands, right?
Leicester. I was born in Leicester, and I lived in a village in the countryside. Ibstock was a mining village, and then Woodhouse Eaves, which was like a posher village. So I got two kind of experiences, and which is good, but. In when I turned 17, my mum got a car, so which I could use, this Winnie with a Mini with fat wheels, and which was important to me at that point. And so me and some friends, we drove to Leicester and to Nottingham. I never knew actually at the time, but Graham Park, who was very much part of the Manchester scene, he used to DJ there. I never knew who the DJ was wasn't important in those days, because often they'd be behind a wall and you couldn't even see them. Maybe they had a little cutout bit so that they could see what was happening or see if the lights were flashing or not.
Like a bird watching box.
Yeah, kind of. And in those times, also is Cool Cat in Nottingham as well, where they used to fill the whole place with smoke so you couldn't see at all in the dance floor. And then they'd put on the strobe. So it was kind of, it was basically like having a fit. and probably if you were likely to have epileptic fits, it was not the place to go. But And the smoke was banana flavour. And
banana flavoured smoke.
Yeah. And and that's where kind of acid dancing started, where people started putting their hands in front of the face like this.
Right.
Because actually they were looking at their fingers flashing in the smoke. And we didn't have any money really, so we had enough money to get in. We never bought a drink. At the end of the night, I used to go up to the bar and say, could I get a glass of water because I'm thirsty? And which is really funny. And we danced like from, I suppose it opened at maybe 10 or 9.30 something. So we'd get on the dance floor and we wouldn't leave till 3.30 when the door shut because it was the
completely
music was
sober.
Yeah, yeah, completely sober. But you had all this smoke and the vibe was very good. And it was like maybe a club culture kind of exploded then as an right. idea. So definitely when I was in Leicester, a place called the Bear Cage, that I think it was their first acid party, and where every single record was acid house, which was very weird at the time. All nyep, 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 nyep. No one knew what to make of it, which was so exciting. And but I remember going there in Leicester town centre, and there was in those days, I mean, we talk about violence and how society is now, but I mean, there was like a gang in Leicester called the Baby Squad. They're all about 14. There'd be about 40 to 50 of them in a pack, and they all had knives. And I remember them kind of shouting wanker at me. And because at that time, if you were into clubbing and alternative culture, it was a definite kind of, it meant you were into peace and love and right. kind of, which wasn't cool mm-hmm. on the football terraces until about 1988. When they all started doing pills, and that actually got rid of lots of violence. So, which I thought was kind of a new summer of love, kind of 1960s, and which was really exciting. And I went to uni in 88, and I started putting on parties with a couple of friends there, and I started this Peace and Love Society, which was the idea that we'd kind of dance for peace and love, just me and a couple of female friends that I met when we first got there, who I'm still good friends with now. And, so we did the psychedelic groove, but we didn't play any psychedelic music. We had some real hippies came and they were like, where's the psychedelic music, man? and we actually didn't really know what that was. We wanted to play acid house and hip-hop. And so you'd play funk, hip-hop, acid house, anything that was new. It didn't really matter what the genre was. The idea that you had to be into a certain thing. And it was just very much about dancing. And probably then you'd see a lot of, like, also there was a jazz dance scene that was happening at the same time. So I used to go and do jazz dance, and you'd do the splits and pirouettes, and you'd try and outdance each other with duels, kind of jazz duels, like the Cotton Club, that was a film from maybe, I don't know, maybe the 1950s. But, yeah, so that musically, that was a great time. And actually, if I think with my mum's Mini, one time, I think maybe one of the first times I got to drive it, I mean, it wasn't my friends picking me up that I was actually driving. And I remember there, and I put on the radio, and I remember hearing DJ Easy Rock and Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock, It Takes Two. And it was so amazing because it was, it's woo, yeah, woo, yeah, really energetic.
And James Brown sample, right?
It's from It Takes Two to Make a Thing Go Right. It's the Funky People. I'll tell you in a minute. I can't remember. Yeah, it's James Brown, Funky People, Lynn Collins, and, yeah, I should know this.
Apparently,
I used to know
in
this.
My crib sheet, it says, James Brown produced 1972 single Think a Brackets About It by Lynn yeah. Collins.
Yeah,
I think we should
right.
hear it. This is Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock, It Takes Two.
I'm not internationally known, but I'm known to rock the microphone because I get stupid. I mean outrageous. Stay away from me if you're contagious because I'm the winner. No, not a loser to being in sick.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend.
But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.